there, everybody. It is January 3rd, 2013, our first show of the new year. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us an email. Send it on over to Ken at thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. And, of course, go to the Facebook. Type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. Starting off the new year with a bang with our first guest. Hey, first guest, are you ready to go?
I'm ready to go.
Matthew Breen is the editor-in-chief of The Advocate, the nation's oldest and largest LGBT magazine, which just this year celebrated its 45th anniversary. 45th, Matthew.
45th, but if we only cop to 39, then... Yeah, no, we were founded in 1967. It's not the oldest LGBT publication in existence, but it's the longest continuously running, and I think the longest it's ever run.
Look at that. And I didn't even finish your intro. He previously
served.
No, it was exciting.
So sorry.
He previously served as The Advocate's executive editor, and before that, he was the executive editor over at Out Magazine. He's been a publicist, a film critic. He worked for the Sundance Film Festival, and now he's here with us officially. Matthew Breen, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you, and I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, it was great. I want history because we want to start out talking about The Advocate. What place in the landscape of the media do you think that The Advocate occupies?
Well, given its long history and given this groundbreaking work that it's done over its years, I think it's the brand name for LGBT news.
Yeah.
So that, of course, makes my job, you know, a big responsibility. But it's also just a really exciting platform. When we present op-ed or commentary, when we present political or cultural analysis, I think people really pay attention to it. And they know that we take great pains to adhere to the highest standards of reporting and to really try to reach into all corners of LGBT society and culture to pull out the stuff that we think is going to be the stuff of history.
Yeah. Now, as you mentioned, I don't know if you know, you have kind of a big post there at The Advocate.
I try not to think about it that way because that's a little daunting. But
intimidate you. It's very exciting. How would you even describe to people, all right, so I'm the editor-in-chief of The Advocate. I would be very intimidated by that. What does your day even look like?
Well, you know, it changes so much from day to day. When we're in production on a magazine, well, I should step back a second. My job also includes work as editorial director for the company. So
right.
We have HIV Plus magazine, which is not an LGBT title, but that goes to doctor's offices and addresses people with HIV and their families and support systems. We do gay.net, which is a site aimed at young gay men. And we do SheWired.com.
We love SheWired.com.
So on any given day, any one of those things can be like the big thing I'm working on or a print version of the publication, The Advocate. It changes from day to day, and this last electoral cycle was especially busy for us.
Absolutely.
And very exciting. And very, you know, the outcomes were really, really fantastic.
Oh, we'll talk about that because I have some quotes from Editor-in-Chief Matthew Breen on that one, so we'll get there.
But yeah, my day changes based on the news.
Yeah,
which is great. It can be a little schizophrenic sometimes, but you know that's how a newsroom runs. So I like that pace.
Now you were working over at Out Magazine.
Yeah.
When you went from Out to The Advocate, did people yell "traitor, traitor, get out of here, traitor"? How did that transition work?
I had been working because both companies have been long sister sibling publications. I wasn't called the traitor.
Okay, it's good to get that out of the way.
Aaron Hicklin, whom you've interviewed, who is my editor-in-chief at Out, said he understood, and you know he knows my interest in politics and news, and he said he thought it would be a great move for me. So I had support from him as well, and I had initially gone from Los Angeles to New York when we moved. Out Magazine had offices in both places.
Right.
We consolidated in New York. I moved there, and I moved back to L.A. where I had been for, you know, a few years before Out Magazine to do The Advocate again. So it was a coming home of sorts.
Great.
And I was excited for a new challenge, a new kind of publication.
But in my head, there are competing softball teams.
Well,
I need that to be true.
I think at one time that may have been more true than it is now.
Okay.
Aaron and I often talk about what we're planning. We have distinct missions, and there's a voice for Out, and there's a voice for the Advocate, and I don't think that we step on each other's toes very much.
Right.
So I can see how you might see that sort of conflict in the past, but I don't feel it now.
I just want there to be softball teams. I just would like to see who wins. That's all I'm saying. When you were at Out Magazine, did they talk still about my month and a half as an intern there from 1996?
Yeah, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we had to take down the shrine at a certain point. But, yeah, it was mentioned repeatedly.
I bet. I loved that month and a half where I thought I was going to be writing content, but instead I helped open that Banana Republic in Chelsea, and I'm still kind of proud of that. So it's a good time. It's a good time.
Every internship, it's like a snowflake. They're all different.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Well, let's talk about the Advocate, because there we put out to our listeners different questions that they wanted to ask you. And most of the questions had to do about coverage and deciding what to cover, what not to cover. And I would imagine the question that came up the most, it was about trans coverage. And covering the T in LGBT and how that must be challenging as we challenge ourselves to highlight more issues of trans relevance, but that it's not always on the forefront of LGBT media.
Yeah, there still is. I don't think that's true of the Advocate now. I mean, yeah. my first cover was Chaz Bono, as an editor in chief. You know, we cover trans issues, I think, on a daily basis online. It has come to the fore in the mind of a lot of reporters, a lot of editors in the past few years. Previous to that,
mm-hmm.
you could see divisions in camps. You
right.
could see, and I think still to this day, you see a lot of gay men who have a problem with the T being part of the acronym, or you still see vestiges of this sometimes in the Michigan Women's Music Festival.
Absolutely.
Where women who are not born women are not admitted or were not admitted in the past. I don't know if they've updated their policies. But
no, they actually haven't, sadly. But there's a competing one across the street.
Well, that's right. Remember having read about that.
Yeah.
I have not been invited.
Nor I.
But, you know, you still see vestiges of discrimination within our own communities. We are really trying to focus attention on trans issues,
mm-hmm.
the issues that trans people face on a day-to-day basis. You'll see a profile of the new head of SLDN in the front of the next issue.
Fantastic.
And of course, we've been following these horrifying beatings and murders of trans people who are some of the most vulnerable and susceptible people in our various communities internationally. So we're on it.
You're on it.
And we're trying to make sure that everybody is aware that it is an issue that affects us all if we're interested in our rights and our safety.
Well, the second most popular question, I was fascinated by this one. It's almost as if this a couple of our listeners imagine that somewhere on the walls in some office in the Advocate, you are tracking the straight versus gay cover photos. And that you're trying for a balance between, you know, how much do you feature straight people on the cover, allies, which are huge to our community, versus how many LGBT people are on the cover. Is that something that you guys are hyper-conscious of?
I think, honestly, I think that's an outdated complaint.
I love it. That's why we do this show.
Pink was on the cover. She talked about having had girlfriends in the past, so I think that we can count her among LGBT.
That absolutely.
Was the last cover prior to Beth Ditto, who is an out lesbian.
Yeah.
Frank Ocean, these are all this year. We did have President Obama on the cover.
I think that's pretty important.
Being the most visible, you know, head of state on the planet.
Absolutely.
Prior to that was Kelly Okereke, who was the lead singer of Bloc Party.
Love.
You know, like this year, I think apart from Obama, we haven't had, and Pink. I guess you could talk about her as being straight.
No, we'll take her into the community. Okay, if it means right. getting her on the show, Matthew, I'll take her.
Right.
I'm good.
I think we have. I have striven to make sure that LGBT people are the people on the cover.
Fantastic.
And I realize that that's symbolic to a certain degree because our community includes allies, or I believe it should include allies.
Yeah.
But, you know, I have a finite number of covers. It makes sense to me that the space we reserve for cover should, in most cases, go to LGBT people. That is not to say that our culture is only defined by LGBT people. So when we have a culturally defining moment that involves a straight person, Nancy Pelosi, I guess, is another example.
Absolutely.
Who has been one of our most vociferous allies in Congress. We go for that person then, whoever that cultural touchstone person is. That's who we aim for.
I'm all for refuting that complaint. We'll transfer that over to Out and see how they respond, and we'll take it from there. Now, your contributions, some of my favorite things in The Advocate, the 40 under 40 is a project that you worked on, or after I Photoshop it every year, the 41 under 40. Right. We love the commitment to covering youth and people who, you know, maybe aren't as established in their various fields, but are making such a huge difference. I don't like saying despite their age. As someone who works at a college, it's really age is part of their achievement. So what was the impetus for starting that particular section?
Well, it's been a franchise, an element that we've had in each May issue for the past several years. We started talking about it because we wanted to make sure that our audience knew that we were aware that young people make significant contributions,
yeah,
and that they're often unsung. And they often don't have, you know, the established support systems or publicity machines or, you know, whatever else that's around people who are a bit more established.
Indeed.
So young people are doing important work, and we want to foster the idea that young people doing important work is important. You know, I think that sort of idea travels. I think other young people can look to 40 under 40 and see that, you know, I don't know if they want to aspire to it necessarily, although that would be great, but they can see that important work can be recognized.
Oh, I have no problem saying that it is inspirational for me. As someone who's been doing this work and is under 40, it's one of my favorite issues of the year because it greases the wheels to just keep going, because there's so many different parts of the community that say, yeah, in a couple of years you can have more of an effect on that. And mm-hmm. And you guys feature people who don't accept that and say, no, I have a voice and there are changes I want to make.
Yeah, there are amazing young artists and activists and civil servants and revolutionaries.
Absolutely.
Who are really moving our culture forward. And this is one chance we get to laud them and to highlight their achievements and to encourage them to continue those.
Yeah.
And then we've done some web components with, let's see, last year we did, was it 60 over 60? We did something along those lines.
Nice.
So we certainly don't intend to dismiss our older elements of our audience or the people who are doing incredible work and have done so for a lifetime. So it's this is just a chance to highlight those younger folks.
Well, I have four more years of calling it the 41 under 40, and then I'll just have to stick with the out 101, which is fine. Now, you, a few years back, spoke to one of my heroes, and the loss, actually our community's loss at his passing, I think there's no way we could have covered it enough, David Rakoff.
Oh, yeah.
Tell me about interacting with David Rakoff, who, folks listening, if you have not, if fraud is not on your bookshelf, it must be. It must be.
It's a fantastic book. He's a terrific essayist. I forget which sort of term he bristled at. There was a term about that was commonly used about his writing that he didn't like, and I think it might have been essayist. But for lack of knowing, you know, better what he preferred, a lot of his stuff was really phenomenal essays. But he was also sort of this kind of gonzo journalist where he would dive into, you know, he would go to, what is it, Steven Seagal's, like,
yes.
Buddhism retreat. Or do, you know, write about doing a fast for a week, and a lot of that stuff ended up on public radio as well. He is just almost too. I mean, you feel so inadequate talking to him because he's so witty and he's
yeah.
so urbane and he's so, like, you know, he has a perfect command of vocabulary at his fingertips. But he was also warm and friendly and self-deprecating in the interview as well. And, you know, I forget how we started talking about this, but he was telling me about some of his weird collections. And he bought this, like, box full of glass slides of x-rays or photos or something of diseased lungs.
Huh.
And, like, he was one of his prized possessions. But he's like, but I don't know what to do with it. He was a habitual crafter. So I said, that would make a fantastic lampshade. Build him into a lampshade. He's like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to send it to you.
Please say that happened.
It didn't happen.
Okay.
I never followed up on it. So to my great disappointment, I don't have a David Rakoff creation of a lampshade of diseased lung x-ray.
But you have that story, and that's a great story. It really, I'm telling you, that was a great interview. Great interview.
I wish there had been room for more of it, but that's always sort of the tragedy of print. But yeah, he was a terrific voice and a great loss, and Yeah, just like you, I encourage anybody who's listening to pick up any of his books. Don't
great
Get
stuff.
You Comfortable is another good one.
Oh, it's great stuff. I'm not a laugh out loud type of person when I'm reading, and you just can't not laugh at his stuff. It's great.
You can't. His turn of phrase is just perfect.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Now, let's return to the election, because you wrote a great piece, in advance of the election, and you wrote in particular, and we've been, you know, over the past 4+ years of this show, we've been talking about gay Republicans have come up over and over, and our role is not to explain them here, but just highlight that there is a bit of a conundrum there. And you wondered aloud in your writing, you wrote, one thing that I'm really curious to see post-election is the proportion of LGBTs who vote GOP. And I encourage people, and we'll provide the link on our website, for them to check out this piece of yours. It's great. I mean, you really just hit the nail on the head and highlight, okay, there's some conflicts going on here. So here we are post-election. How you feeling?
Well, buoyed at least in part by our mission at The Advocate, I go into an election thinking human rights are the single most important thing that I could ever vote on.
Yeah.
If I don't have that, nothing else is really significant. Nothing else really matters at all. So I go into any election looking at candidates in terms of, does this candidate prefer policies that would extend to me the rights of all citizens? And Obama clearly did, and
right.
Mitt Romney clearly didn't.
Right.
I can't tell anybody else how to vote, you know, but I just am mystified when people say that there are other issues that take precedence over human rights when it comes to an election. You know, that's where some of my curiosity about gay GOP registered voters comes from. It's not to say that I can't fully fathom it. It's that calculation when coming to choose a candidate is so far from mine.
Right.
That I'm endlessly curious about it. We've had posted commentaries and op-ed pieces from people who have said that they are, you know, Republican and they vote that way based on tax issues or other financial issues, but it usually comes down to finance.
Right. But how do you get past the civil rights piece and the human rights?
I never get past it.
Yeah.
I can't fathom getting past equality.
Right. That's as simple as that. Now, did you start writing an op-ed in your head with the possibility of a President Romney?
Oh, gosh, there's no end of op-eds. Has there been a President Romney?
How much do you all at The Advocate have to prepare for that possibility? I mean, yes, we could all just listen to Nate Silver and just trust what he says is correct, but
right.
You know, there's the possibility that it might not go this way. So how much do you all need to prepare content for that possibility, or do you really just wait for it to happen?
Well, there's so much that's an unknown
right.
When a new president comes in. You don't know what his cabinet is going to look like. You
right.
Don't know, you know, all we could do is sort of look at speeches and policy papers and votes in the past and try to project how much that would be evident in something like a President Romney.
Mm-hmm.
With Romney, it was especially difficult because he said anything to suit the audience he was speaking to. You never knew if you were listening to what he truly believed or a policy position that he would truly act upon. You know, he said that he would be more pro-LGBT than Ted Kennedy running for a Senate seat.
Right.
And then he, you know, later on, and I think it was a Chris Matthews interview, said, I can't believe LGBT people are actually having children. He was, like, disgusted at the idea. We had no idea where to place him, you know. So people who said, he's not really as conservative as he looks, you know, well, that's pure speculation because he might even be more conservative. If he can be backed into a corner in a speech, if he can be, you know, tied down to certain ultra-conservative anti-gay positions in debates or speaking to conservative groups, then why wouldn't he be the same in the White House?
Right.
So, you know, we speculated and we had all sorts of worst-case scenarios in our heads. And, of course, you know, I'm surprised the Supreme Court wasn't a greater discussion during the election than it was. But we just imagined disastrous long-term results from Romney Supreme Court nominees. But he was such an enigma that
you never knew what you were going to get.
We never really knew.
Right.
Exactly. We never knew.
Well, that is an endless supply of op-eds then, because so many possibilities.
So many horrible possibilities.
Well, I did mention Nate Silver, and Nate Silver was named Out Magazine's Person of the Year,
yes.
Which is great. One of his quotes, though, and I was kind of interested to get your take on this, and we talked about this in one of our last shows of – 2012, but he said his friends would describe him as sexually gay but ethnically straight. And he goes on in this interview with Aaron Hicklin to talk a little bit about Keith Haring. He has a couple different shout-outs, but a lot of it is around the label of being gay, that he says, I don't want to be Nate Silver, gay statistician, any more than I want to be known as white, half-Jewish statistician who lives in New York. And I got it, and I understood that. But then at the same time, he was being named Out Magazine's Person of the Year. And struggled with that a little bit in reading his comments. I think he's a great choice, but at the same time, I wasn't too sure how to reconcile some of the identity politics that he was putting forth.
Yeah, having not spoken to Nate myself, you know, I don't know where he sort of sits on the continuum as like a spokesperson for LGBT,
right.
or for rights, or having even sort of that language at his fingertips. I think, you know, I had problems with a few of the things he said as well, but he may not, as some people aren't, just really be equipped with the idea that that might be offensive to somebody, or
right.
that might come across as sort of a little self-loathing or a little internally homophobic. Some people don't know that they're saying, you know, that what they're saying can come off as homophobic until they've been confronted with the idea. I think by ethnically straight, I think he means that he, you know, is likely to be found drinking beer and watching a football game at a sports bar with his friends more often than going to Musical Mondays, you know, at Splash or something like that.
Right.
But, you know, if that's really his view of what gay is, I don't know if it is. If that's his view of what gay is, it's a little limiting. So, you know, ethnically straight, it was a little tone deaf to me, but... But apart from that, I think he's really, you know, he's a genius.
He is.
And his energies, his thought may just be focused elsewhere.
I have to say, and you articulated perfectly my conflict in that, you know, Musical Mondays on Splash does not typify the gay community, even as I'm so excited because I miss going to Musical Mondays at Splash. So it's really a conflict that you've articulated for a whole audience.
If he's thinking about it in those sort of black and white or, you know, pink and whatever, some other straight color,
I don't know what that
would be, terms, then it's a little reductive. And, you know, maybe he will see the light.
Yes. Well, we're here to help. We're here to help. So we do have to talk about your song selections for this week's episode. Very exciting. I thought you made up these songs, but it turns out they're real. I didn't know any of these. So this is the part of the show, Matthew Breen, where you tell our listening audience what some of your song selections say about Matthew Breen. It's a little self-analysis for our listening audience. And again, I confirmed that these are real songs because we're playing them this episode. Let's start with Santa Maria. Is it the Gotan Project?
Gotan Project, yeah.
What does Santa Maria by the Gotan Project say about Matthew Breen?
Well, this is Gotan Project is this great outfit that does sort of remixes of tango music. And these are just some of the sexiest, this is some of the sexiest music that I have ever heard. And I'm instantly transported whenever I hear any of their songs, and this just takes me to Spain, like, immediately.
Lovely.
And it just transports me to, you know, Granada and watching some flamenco dancers, you know, from the caves in the hills in one of these amazing old restaurants performing.
Now, see, I kind of imagine that the attitude there, the climate in the Advocate offices are kind of like flamenco dancers in caves in the hills.
That is a wild imagining. I cannot confirm that.
Okay, but you didn't deny it, so keep going.
Travel's a big part of what I love about this job. I have the opportunity to go see different places and visit, you know, places I've never seen before, and then look at what gay life is like there, and, you know, let people know where that's some place they want to travel and experience. And Gotan just takes me there right away.
There you go. There you go. All right, we'll make you do one more.
Right.
Lebanese Blonde by the Thievery Corporation. What does Lebanese Blonde say about Matthew Breen?
This is another one of these songs that transports me. Thievery Corporation is a really fantastic DJ duo out of D.C., but their music is just so international, and every song is just this perfectly crafted. There's some lounge beats, there's Latin beats, there's Middle Eastern beats, and this is just, I imagine, you know, going to, I mean, like Moroccan souks or something in my head when I hear, well, I guess I should be in Lebanon. I don't know. I've never been to Lebanon.
Up.
I can't imagine this, but it's one of these songs that transports me as well.
You're the editor-in-chief. You get to mix metaphors.
Okay, good.
It's totally fine. It's totally fine. Well, I have to tell you, there's no possible way that we, everyone here at the show So Gay, can stress enough the importance of The Advocate. And TheAdvocate.com, which is just a daily source of information and op-eds, and it inspires, I mean, really, over the past close to 5 years of this show, it's inspired so much of our content here. You guys do such amazing work there and provide the most important thing of providing a voice to folks that we wouldn't normally hear their voices in covering the issues that are so important to both the LGBT and ally community. I would imagine you just love your staff there. They do such great work.
They are phenomenal. They are incredibly hardworking. They are very knowledgeable and have been doing this for, you know, some of them for a long time. And their dedication to the stories that they're telling is inspiring to me on a daily basis. So I thank you for that compliment, and I'll be sure to pass that along, because it's hard sometimes to see the impact of the work that we do, but we're delighted to know that it makes an impact.
No, you guys provide access to folks just all over the world who may not have access to various parts of the gay community. And I will tell you, obviously they have an able leader, and we, in our putting out there, what do you want to ask Matthew Breen, one of our listeners wrote back, and I think they really encapsulated the core of your journalistic essence when they wrote, my gosh, and I'm reading this as a quote, my gosh, did he have a pretty suit for the 45th anniversary party. So there you go. I mean, that's all your years of journalism are summed up right there. It really was quite a nice suit, Matthew.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Matthew Breen, you and everyone over at The Advocate, suffice to say, please keep doing what you're doing.
We definitely will. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Matt. Well, if we are going to talk about 2013, this being our first show of 2013, we must, of course, go to our go-to gay, our favorite of all the go-to gays, our media expert, Kathy Renna. Welcome back to the show, So Gay.
Thank you so much.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too.
How did you celebrate?
Quietly.
Okay. We love that. We love that.
It was the year to celebrate quietly. It's all good.
Well, before we even look at 2013, let's look back a little bit at 2012. Mm-hmm. Not a bad year for the gays.
No. I mean, you know, I keep hearing this word watershed, you know, which you hear every once in a while about things. But I think it really was. I mean, I think the primary thing, of course, was the elections.
Yeah.
And by that, I mean sort of in an all-encompassing way. It wasn't just that we reelected President Obama. It's that we won in not one or two or three, but all four states that were battling marriage initiatives, which, you know, the odds of that I thought were fairly low, so it was thrilling. And lots of other stories, you know, over the course of the year that, you know, small steps forward.
Yeah.
Whether it was somebody coming out, you know, like Anderson Cooper.
Right.
Or, you know, whether it were, it was, you know, a victory in small ways, whether it was young people standing up to, you know, folks at school who were bullying them or, you know, dealing with these issues that we don't talk about as much and that we're now really starting to. So, yeah, it was a huge year, and I think this year is going to be just tremendous.
We haven't actually talked to you since the election, and one of the questions that we posed, because right after the election, there were a lot of op-eds saying, all right, what do we do next? What do we do next? And one of the things we talked about on the show was, can we pause for a second and celebrate? As someone who looks at the media, how are we doing in the community with the celebrating?
I think we're doing pretty well. I mean, I know people were extremely happy and talking a lot about the election results in a way that was celebratory.
Yeah.
Was sort of, and not just patting, you know, people on the back for doing good stuff, but really saying, look, this is a clear indication that we are making tremendous progress culturally and now finally catching up on a political and legislative front. And that to me has always been the big thing, is that we, you know, doing the cultural work is critical to making the other pieces happen. You're not going to get politicians to change policies until they realize that the people who vote for them are not going to support them.
Right. Right. But, well, that's 2012. We're into 2013 now, and quite a bit to look forward to. I would imagine the first thing that kind of hangs over our heads in maybe an amazing way, maybe in a, oh gosh, what's going to happen way, is the Supreme Court.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, just to step back for a sec, I think the big thing, that the really big picture thing, is that this is Obama's second term.
Right.
And as we all know, got nothing to lose in your second term because you can't get, you're not running. You're not running for anything. So, you know, the idea that we can expect, I think, even more from the Obama administration as it relates to, you know, speaking out against DOMA, which obviously can potentially have a huge impact on the Supreme Court decision,
right,
as well as continued victories. We've got, you know, Illinois is poised to vote on marriage equality.
It seems like any minute now.
Any second. I think it's like tonight.
All right.
So, you know, there's that, and I also think there's a possibility for some other real, you know, important steps, like a milestone such as maybe an openly LGBT cabinet member, which we've never had. You know, more LGBT people being put in positions of, you know, very sort of high level within the administration. And also, I'm hoping, you know, in my crystal ball here, I'm hoping that we start to talk about ENDA.
Right.
Because that's really, you know, to me, all this conversation about marriage and all the other issues is so important, but people just don't understand that there are 30-something states where you can be fired because you're gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender. And even gay people don't know that. You know?
Right.
And so it's a pretty basic issue, and it seems like a no-brainer.
And not anybody who's currently on this call, so not you nor I, but I think that there are people in the community, because we've been talking about ENDA for so long, that think, oh, wait, we already accomplished that.
Oh, absolutely. It's kind of like when they struck down the sodomy laws. I mean, I had journalists and gay people going, those were on the books?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Supreme Court just struck them down. So it really, there is a, you know, education that continues to need to be done. But no, I think absolutely the second term of the Obama administration is going to be it's a critical piece of a lot of the progress we make at the national, federal level. And I think there are a ton of other things happening as well.
Well, there's a lot of predicting what President Obama is going to say, what he's going to do. Is there any predicting what the Supreme Court is going to do?
I think that's always really hard. I mean, the Supreme Court is like, you know, they're an enigma wrapped in a mystery.
Right.
In robes. Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's really difficult. I think that most of the people that I'm talking to are hopeful, primarily because the organizations bringing the cases forward have been super smart.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to be the Supreme Court and have Edie Windsor coming up against me.
No.
Got news for you. I know her. She will bring it. You know, and yeah, I wouldn't want to, you know, have to stand up to her. So I think they've chosen really, really wisely, both of the cases, you know, GLAD and AFER and Lambda and all the others, and they're working together really well. And, you know, that's the important thing, is that dismantling DOMA a piece at a time was the right strategy. Going after the whole enchilada, not going to happen.
Right.
So I think that, frankly, as far as I'm concerned, I'm extremely hopeful for a good decision. It all kind of hinges on my paisan there, Justice Scalia. But, you know, we'll see what happens. We saw some incredible, incredible things come out of the Supreme Court from people we didn't expect when the sodomy laws were struck down years ago. So, again, I'm hopeful.
Now, I want to stick with hope because, you know, it's a new year, so I don't want to go too negative. But certainly some of the emails that we've gotten from listeners are a little bit of fear that there is the potential for so much gain with the Supreme Court, but once they take on a case, holy cow, is there potential for some setbacks?
Well, yeah, because a bad decision is huge.
Yeah.
You know, it has such impact. But I think at the same time, one of the things that I think is really important to sort of look at is beyond that. Like, that's the thing that, not that I say it sucks the air out of the room, but it gets all the attention. And what I think people don't necessarily see is that all around the issue of marriage, there are other issues that people are starting to really take on in interesting, smart ways, ways that the community has not done before and that are starting to get more visibility. And I'm hoping that 2013 is a year where, and this is kind of part of the work that we do at Renner Communications, but I know, you know, all the organizations that work on these issues are very, very hopeful that the community will start paying more attention to things like homeless LGBT youth.
Yes.
On a ton. And which is finally getting a lot of attention. More attention paid to sort of youth and family issues and family acceptance. And we work with the Family Acceptance Project. And, you know, the work they did last year, which was huge related to Mormon families, is having a tremendous impact and starting to really shake up all the folks in that very large temple in Salt Lake City.
Right.
Make them really reconsider and think about the way that the church has treated their LGBT children and the impact that that's had, which, you know, ties in with youth and suicide and faith and all these other issues that, frankly, we're talking about more than ever.
Talk to me about doing communications work, LGBT communications work, in a non-election year. Is there less competition coming up? Is it harder to get people's attention? What does the road ahead look like for you doing that kind of work?
It's kind of a mixed bag. I mean, I think the good thing is that we're not competing. I mean, competing with an election, a presidential election year, is always hard unless your issues tie into what's going on, which in this case last year, there were a number of them, not all of them, but many. I think in a non-election year, you have to fight a little bit to get people's attention, but once you get it, there's a much higher chance and a much better opportunity, I think. And we have some really interesting milestones coming up, I think, in the community. I mean, it's a really, again, you know, we deal with all kinds of issues, both political and cultural, at the firm. And so, like, for example, we're going to be working with Creating Change, which is the national LGBT conference that the National Lesbian and Gay Task Force puts on. They're celebrating their 25th anniversary as a conference.
Look at that.
It's like two of them. 3,000-plus LGBT activists from around the country, ranging in age from, like, literally, and I mean this quite literally, like 1,200.
Yeah.
It's incredible. And the task force is going to be celebrating its 40th anniversary. I mean, we're really, I think, going to have a chance to look back at how far we've come. Because I think people get discouraged easily. But if you really think about it, we're a young movement, and
right,
we've come incredibly far. But we also still have a ton to do. So it's a chance to sit down and say, okay, let's talk about how we don't talk about HIV anymore. And why is that? Is it because of who's being impacted by it? You know, let's talk about why the blood ban on gay and bisexual men donating blood is still stands.
That's my issue.
Seems like a no-brainer. Right. Seems like a no-brainer. Exactly. You know, and other things as well. And then, you know, like, for example, in February, we're working on something that's so close to my heart and so meaningful and so powerful, the Laramie Project, which has been performed for, you know, over a decade. They went back 10 years later and re-interviewed people and created a whole other piece of work, which is an epilogue. And it's fascinating, and it's finally going to be produced in New York at BAM, which is the Brooklyn Academy of
Music
and the Arts.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like Angels in America now. You know, you're going to see the first one, and that's a, you know, 2.5-3 hours, and then you're going to have dinner, and then you're going to come back and see the epilogue. And I think this will offer a platform for an entire new generation of performances of this play that has already had so much impact. But really, you know, now that when I go out and talk to high school kids, they were 2 or 3 when Matthew Shepard.
Oh, my gosh.
And so, right, so they don't know. And so there's that, and then the other issue is that the epilogue is extraordinary in that when they went back, what they found out was that people had kind of rewritten history. They were in complete denial that they thought it was a drug deal gone bad. It
wasn't a hate crime. Gosh.
And, you know, despite all the evidence to the contrary. And so it's a real examination of how a town can be so impacted by an event that is that horrifying, that gets that much media attention, that sort of, you know, kind of marks them with the, you know, like the scarlet letter, you know, of H for hate crime, and how they handle that. And it's really fascinating. And the really interesting thing about it is that for the first time, with the permission of Matthew Shepard's parents, the perpetrators were interviewed in prison. She allowed the members of Tectonic Theater Project to go in and talk to Aaron and Russell. And so, and
wow.
Also Judy Shepard was interviewed, which, you know, she's like family to me, and she is somebody I am so protective of. And, you know, she doesn't really like doing media that much, to be totally frank. And so she agreed to talk to Moises, and she closes the play, and it's so powerful.
Wow.
So we're excited, and what it means now is that after a few weeks of performances in Brooklyn, the play can then go out into the world, just like the first one, and be performed as the first one was thousands of times, everywhere from high schools to community theaters to, you know, major theaters, productions in major cities. And so that whole, just the whole thing is really exciting to work on. And it's one of those things where, you know, it'll get a lot of media attention, but it's not like a piece of legislation.
Right.
But I would argue that it has as much impact in many ways, because the thousands of people who see it, and certainly the people who participate in it as actors and producers, directors, you know, students, et cetera, I've been to, you know, I've seen it dozens of times, all they talk about is how it's changed their lives. And so...
Do we need a handbook? I think we might need a handbook, because I've had these conversations with my college students about Matthew Shepard, and look, he and I were the same age, and when we did our 100th show years ago, there was no other guest I wanted than Judy Shepard, and it was such an amazing honor to speak with her. But then, you know, I speak to my college students, and they have some vague recollection of seeing something on reruns on MTV. And then I get into that mode of, okay, so how much do I need to educate? Which, of course, is 100%, and I'm always all about it. But I can't wait for this second half to come out, because I will bring students to that.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Come to New York.
You don't have to entice me.
My guest, I'm working.
You don't have to entice me.
You can come as media. Come as press.
Look at that. I've never had a press badge before, by the way.
Badge, free tickets, you know, just take advantage of that. You know, being a journalist, it is really going to be amazing. And they're actually in the middle of the production cycle. There's a weekend where Judy Shepard's going to come and going to do a sort of a symposium with Moises Kaufman,
wow.
Who's the co-director with Lee Fondakowski of both plays, and also some other folks. And I think offer an opportunity for dialogue around this and the impact of it. That's going to be really
It's going to be amazing.
Anybody who cares about these issues, or who cares about the impact that theater can have, and how arts and theater entertainment can have a real huge impact culturally, as much as some of the political activism we do.
Absolutely, and we're seeing that with the It Gets Better, the musical project, and no, there's a lot going on out there. Hey, in the realm of things that people think have been solved, but perhaps aren't 100% solved, how are we doing with the military? It's not all roses there.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, we worked a ton on things with OutServ primarily, and also the Palm Center, which was a think tank that worked on specifically on the issue of sexual orientation in the military. And, you know, OutServ and the Service Members Legal Defense Network did a really smart thing, which is they got together, they joined as organizations, and now basically are the organization that is charged with what else needs to be done. And there's a ton that needs to be done. You know, there are issues around marriage and partners and families that need to be addressed. I'm sure a lot of folks listening have read the story of Charlie Morgan, who's a woman who, with her wife and their young daughter, I think she's 4 or 5, she's been to Afghanistan 2 or 3 times. She has had cancer a number of times, and she's in remission. And this issue of her spouse, legal spouse, getting any benefits is a question because of DOMA.
Right.
So it's another way to sort of look at the issue of marriage and DOMA. Also, you know, now's the time to start. It's not going to happen quickly, but the idea of talking about transgender people in the military and the inclusion of transgender people in the military is something that needs to start happening. You know, we're not don't ask, don't tell being repealed was really in some ways, it took a long time, but it was the beginning.
Right.
It was the beginning of a process. So we're seeing a lot more from them and a lot more work. And my hope is that, you know, people in the community do understand that because, you know, what can happen is they'll say, oh, you repealed, don't ask, don't tell, we don't need to give you money anymore. And so they are a little bit smaller now, a little bit tighter, but I think they're ready to, you know, plan and come back in the ways that that they need to tackle all these other issues.
You know, we went off a little bit on that story, Media Lady, because we had some difficulties with, we talked about it a few weeks ago when the story came out, difficulties on how the story was portrayed in the media, because you, of course, had at the heart of it, how is his spouse not being able to access equal benefits than everybody else in the military? But the degree to which the media really hyped, this is how long they've been together, this is, you know, this is their child situation, and it just kind of started screaming, okay, this would not be as valid of a story if perhaps they weren't together. You know, they had just gotten together a few months ago, they didn't have any children, and it was just really surprising. We had a couple pundits on our show talking about that it felt not manufactured because it's a real story, but that they would not have been highlighted as much if they had not been together as long, if they had not been as, I think one of our guests used the word stable.
Well, you know, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, this is what I do for a living.
Right.
When you want the media to tell a story, you need to give them the most powerful story you can. And when you want them to tell a story about LGBT people, because of the decades of misinformation, stereotype, and crap that they've done about us, you know, it's really important to find families and couples with compelling stories that will actually reach people. I mean, the thing about, you know, Charlie and her wife, and I know them really, really well, is that their story is very complex, as you said. I mean, they, you know, they have, there's so many facets to it. But the I hate to say good thing, but the effective thing about that is that they can reach a ton of people. People who have dealt with, you know, major health issues with their husbands, wives, or partners. You know, people with kids and families, people, it's such an obvious, compelling, it's heartbreaking. And that's the story, frankly, that the media is going to pay more attention to. Things that are boring, frankly, the media is not going to pay attention to. So, you know, and they were very willing to do it. And it was done in a way where they felt like they were being treated with respect, and their story was being told accurately, and not in a sensational way. Because there's really, you know, how do you sensationalize what's already an incredibly, you know, powerful, dramatic, gut-wrenching story?
Right.
So it's just the reality of the media, too. I mean, I'm not blaming the media. It is what it is, and we have to deal with it.
Well, I'm going to get your take on one more story, and then I have promised our listeners that I'm going to let this story go because I can't seem to stop talking about it. So you had Nate Silver, right, who was named the out person of the year, and I'm sure you've had conversations about it. What about someone who's being named the Out Magazine Person of the Year, LGBT publication, making such a point of saying that they are ethnically straight?
I know.
I can't let it go. I don't know what's wrong with me. You are now like the fourth guest that I've discussed. We even talked about it earlier this show with Matthew Breen.
I might want to talk to a therapist.
I think I need to talk to Nate Silver. For some reason, it's like it's fine to me if, say,
it's just silly because, you know,
I hate
honestly,
it.
Like, I could kind of say the same thing because, like, what do? I get up in the morning and take my kid to school.
Right.
You know, I spend more time with, you know, straight parents and play dates than I'm sure a lot of other, you know, that's, I don't even know what that means anymore to be like ethnically anything. I mean, we are finally at a place where people in our community, in the LGBT community, have the capacity to live lives in a fuller, more diverse way than we ever had before. And the public is recognizing that we are far more diverse than they ever thought.
Yeah.
So that's where it gets all gray and blurry, and, you know, this idea of, like, putting a label on something or sticking somebody, you know, checking off a box, it's getting harder. And I got news for Nate and you and everybody that there's a generation of young people coming up who are like, I don't want to check off a box.
Right.
I don't want you to label me, okay? And they're the ones that are going to push the envelope, and you're not going to hear any of them saying they're ethnically straight or they're, you know, you know, don't let, things are a spectrum, things are gray, that's okay, I'm okay with that. And they're going to let go of a lot of the identity politics, because that's what probably that came from. I'm not going to, I don't know him, I can't analyze him, I'm not a therapist, But the reality is people say things like that for a reason.
Yeah.
And he probably does really feel like that. And it's maybe because he's just not ready to fully identify, or he doesn't want to, or who knows?
All right, I'm going to let the story go because I can think of no better way than starting 2013 than Kathy Renna telling me that I need to go get therapy.
Yeah, there you go. That's a resolution you wouldn't get from anybody. There are actually a couple of things that I would love to throw in. I mean, I think there are stories that, particularly in terms of international stuff, that we're finally paying more attention to. I mean, the big ones, obviously, what's going on in Uganda.
Yeah.
Awful, awful nightmare. But also all these other countries where, you know, things are happening on the marriage front, you know, that folks are ahead of us in lots of places, behind us in others, and that we're becoming more of an international movement, which I think is great. And then there are some very specific stories that I think people should keep their eyes open for. I mean, one is this continued, I mean, we mentioned the blood ban, we mentioned HIV, which I think will only grow, and if I have anything to do about it, we'll help with that. But the two stories, one is this continuing chipping away at the, I'm hesitant to even use the word legitimately in the same sentence, as these ex-gay, you know, therapies,
yeah.
Gay, you know, religious programs where they're going to pray away the gay or whatever. I think there are going to be more legal battles like the one in California. I think that it's possible there's going to be one in Jersey. I think, you know, people are really starting to look at that. And then on a sort of related note, in the sense that these are all things that, like, the American Psychiatric Association, the American Psychological Association, and those folks are dealing with, is that in the spring, the new DSM-3 will come out, which
right.
is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Health Illnesses and kind of codes and descriptions. And there have been some major changes related to gender identity and transgender people. And, you know, the controversial in some ways, because I think there's a difference of opinion in even in the transgender community around what is the most effective, best thing. But the bottom line, and I know people who are on the committee who have worked on this literally for years now. It's been 3 or 4 years. But I think it's going to have a huge impact, because what it will do is it will begin to remove the stigma. And that's where you need to start. And
yeah.
So I'm thrilled that the changes have been made. I think the majority of transgender people are. I think the challenge is that taking it out of the DSM fully, or, you know, in a way that would essentially not give folks access to health insurance benefits or the kind of medical care they need to really go through the transition process, is the kind of fly in the ointment.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. But I still think, bottom line, removing the stigma, it kind of like in 1973 when they took, you know, homosexuality out of the DSM completely, is a huge historic thing that might get missed in the media, might not, I'm not sure, but is a tremendous milestone for the trans community that we cannot deny.
All right, we got to keep our eyes on that. Hey, if someone out there needs some media help and they actually want to pay for it, what website can they go to?
They can go to my website, which is www.rennacommunications. It's R-E-N-N-A, communications with an S.com. And I'm happy to talk to anybody.
Perfect, perfect. Well, you know that you're our favorite go-to gay for all of these stories.
You got to call me the go-to lesbian.
I'm sorry.
That label I'll take. I am kind of a gay guy. We all know that.
Then it becomes GTL, though, and that's like a whole Jersey Shore reference that I don't – yeah, it's not good. It's not good.
And I haven't seen Les Mis yet, so I could lose my standing.
Whoa. I don't understand. I don't – do I have to just delete this whole interview from the first – it's okay. Get on it.
I love the play. I love the musical. I'm scared to see the movie.
It's – yeah. It's an experience. Let's go with that. Let's go with that. Kathy Renna, love starting out 2013 with you.
Absolutely, me too.
All right, keep us posted.
I will.
Bye.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
All right, folks, that about wraps things up for this week's episode, episode 196, which means episode 200 coming up real soon. As always, if you have any guest ideas or feedback or just something gay you want to get off your mind, send it on over to Ken at thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun guests coming up on our show, like Willem. We love Willem from RuPaul's Drag Race. I'm going to have my hand right on the edit button there. But that is going to be a fun-filled show. And, of course, stroll on over to the Facebook, type in "This Show Is So Gay." You can find our page there. Join the thousands of people who like us there. We're always about sharing information, linking you up to new episodes, including shared this past week my newest article in the Huffington Post on my search for an out gay male professional tennis player. Some great feedback on there, some bizarre feedback on there, but mostly great feedback on there. So link us up on Facebook and you can find all of that content. We got to get out of here. Happy New Year to all of you amazing listeners. Hope your 2013 has started off amazingly well. Get out there, folks. Go do some amazing things. Use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference in this world. As you start up 2013, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?